Have you ever wondered what it's like to experience something paranormal, supernatural, or unexplainable? Join host Jack Wagner on the podcast Otherworld as he explores spine-chilling real stories shared by everyday people who have experienced something unexplainable. Listen each week for first-person testimony from people who have come face-to-face with something that can't just be explained away. Listen and follow Otherworld, an Odyssey podcast, available now on the Odyssey app or wherever you get your podcasts.
It is a Count Basie Bumper Music Tuesday here on WWL. Kelly Schultz joins us, Senior Vice President of Communications, Public Relations for New Orleans and Company. This music is before my day, Kelly, but it's still pretty good, don't you think?
It's very good. Yes. Good morning, Tommy.
You know who did a lot of work with Count Basie?
Who?
Did a lot of work with Michael Jackson as well.
Oh, really?
Yes, he did.
Okay.
Frank Sinatra, too.
I thought he would be playing Taylor Swift music for me.
No, Frank Sinatra, too, he did, as a matter of fact. Quincy Jones helped arrange them all, believe it or not. So there you go. I wish I would have played some Taylor Swift music. We'll play some for you as you go out. How you doing, Kelly Schultz?
Doing well. How are you? Thanks for having me today.
Thank you. I've heard it referred to as Swifty Grog, Swiftsmas. I don't know. Tell me, how big was the Taylor Swift concert to the area?
Well, the concert was huge, and we had a really great weekend. We know that there were about 150,000 visitors in town. The airport on Sunday broke a record for the most passengers through the TSA checkpoint, with 32,000 passengers leaving the city on Sunday.
Really?
So it was just a really great, really, really great weekend. We think about, $200 million easily in direct spending. If you think about the money that was spent on hotels and meals and concert tickets for the Caesars Superdome, and then all of the costumes and accessories and just, fun that people were having in celebration of Taylor Swift. And then, of course, all of this coincided with the big Halloween weekend. So it was a huge, huge weekend for us.
Kelly, when it comes to Super Bowl, and it's not a competition, right, because everybody wins. I'm not trying to make it a competition. But it seems like you could make a case that this is as big as a Super Bowl. And what I mean by that is, people on the ground, feet on the ground, Super Bowls have become corporate, not to denigrate Super Bowls at all, but sometimes people fly in for the game, fly out for the game. It seems like this was a crowd that came, they stayed, they spent money, and they liked what they saw, and they enjoyed the time they had.
They absolutely did. Every event is different, but what we've been saying, Tommy, is that I don't know of another city that can say within 6 months they're going to host three Taylor Swift shows, a Super Bowl, and Mardi Gras, and major conventions like the National Association of Automobile Dealers and many, many other prominent conventions that we're going to be hosting over the next 6 months. So this is really where New Orleans shines. We like to say that we're built to host, and I think you saw that this weekend. The NOPD did an incredible job. The city, the Caesars Superdome staff, everyone was really working at their best and made things run smoothly. The crowds seemed to be, joyous and happy. And I saw huge crowds everywhere I went around the city over the weekend. So it was really what New Orleans does best is making people happy, creating memorable experiences, and doing so in a way that is managed very, very well.
Did you have a chance to meet Ms. Swift, or did any member of your organization chat with Ms. Swift about her thoughts on the city and the concert and so forth?
I did not, and I don't even think our CEO did, actually. But Taylor Swift, from what I read, did say some nice things about New Orleans. And, we were honored to be added. This is sort of the end of her Eras tour, and last October, she announced that New Orleans was one of only about five cities that she was going to select for the ending of the tour. So if you think about New Orleans, of course, we think every major concert should be here. I mean, we had Beyonce fairly recently, which was also huge. We had the Rolling Stones here for Jazz Fest. So, we love that these massive artists are selecting New Orleans. And with Taylor Swift, she has been in some pretty global iconic cities all over the world, and we're just really happy to be part of it. And she had three really, really strong shows here. I know she was impressed with the friendship beads that the Superdome put on the outside of the building. That was a really creative touch, and she did comment on that. So the Superdome just did an amazing job.
So how do you follow up? How does New Orleans and Company follow up on something this big, this successful, and build on it and enhance on it and use it almost, I hate to say, as a resume item, but as an example, a selling point to get other things like this?
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, we're gonna keep doing what we do every day, which is working with our partners at the city, with the New Orleans Police Department, with the amazing Louisiana Troop NOLA group that has come in to provide extra police protection in the city, and just really, you know, work hard and sell the city. I mean, this week, for example, you know, the day that Taylor Swift concerts ended, we had 13,000 nurses arriving in the city for a convention with the American Nurses Association. We also have the MusicCon conference this week. So we, you know, would love to see a weekend like we had last weekend every day of the year. So that's what we're focused on, is making sure we flawlessly execute the Super Bowl, of course doing Mardi Gras, but it's all of the conventions, all of the events, all of the hospitality that we do every day is what we're going to do to keep moving the city forward.
Shout outs to any specific groups. I know you hate to start this because you don't want to leave anybody off, but you mentioned the Superdome and NOPD for having the Taylor Swift thing go off. And I would think flawlessly, would that be an overstatement?
No, I mean, from what I've heard, it went really, really well. The Homeland Security Office of the Mayor's Administration had really good things to say. And also, I will credit our hospitality community, our hotels and our restaurants and our cultural attractions. They were doing a lot of really creative Taylor Swift activations with special events and glitter parties and Taylor Swift-themed cocktails and menus. And so, you know, Flirty Girl, the store, had Taylor Swift merchandise everywhere at all of her stores. So our community really came together and did what they do best, which is make people feel welcome, make people feel special, and just give them a really memorable experience. I've talked to lots of people who were here for the first time. And that's another thing that's exciting about this is that, you know, many of these young ladies maybe have never been to New Orleans before, but we hope that we made a good impression and they'll want to return on future visits, you know, really throughout their lifetime.
I know you have a daughter. Did your daughter get to go?
She did not go. Aww. We didn't even try and get tickets because it was so much demand. I didn't even try. But everyone that
Swiftie?
I talked to, she's really not.
Oh,
I hate to say.
Oh,
she's
okay.
More.
No.
She's more into country music.
I'd rather her not be a Swiftie and not go than be a Swiftie and not be able to go. So that's fine.
Right.
No,
so, right.
Different
choice.
That's fine.
She was not disappointed.
That's
right.
Perfect.
But I know a lot of people were disappointed if they tried to get tickets. But everyone that I talked to that went just had wonderful things to say about the way everything was managed. And, of course, Taylor Swift is just spectacular performer and artist, and it really, you know, this is what New Orleans does best, and we're really proud of the city. And again, you know, this was one weekend, but we need to keep it up and keep moving and keep bringing in events and visitors and creating good experiences for people every day of the year.
Kelly, somebody texted in that the airport looked great, and I presume everything works. You talked about the number of people that went out on the last day. Everything worked pretty well there too, did it not?
It did. From what I'm hearing, it went smoothly. As I said, they had a record passenger count on Sunday departing the city. 32,000 people went through the TSA checkpoint. And again, I think people went there in good spirits, knowing it's going to be crowded, as it is, as when people are leaving the city for Essence Fest or any other, you know, Jazz Fest or major, major events. And I think, yes, I think the airport did a great job. I was at the airport on Friday and they had a Taylor Swift, you know, balloon arch and all of these things where people immediately, after getting their baggage, were able to take photos and feel welcomed. And again, our city really shines when it comes to these types of big events, making people feel welcome, giving them great photo ops and memories. We've really, from the airport to every person in the hospitality community and beyond. We just, they did a fantastic job. And a special, special thanks to New Orleans Police Department. We saw lots of police officers engaging with all of the visitors, and it was just a really good weekend.
And look, I'm not a Swiftie, because once you get that glitter on your face, you'll never get it out of the house. You know how that goes. But real quick, what do we have coming up between now and, say, the Super Bowl?
Well, again, you know, I mentioned we've got 13,000 nurses in town. We have the National Association of Automobile Dealers, which is huge. We've got lots of other groups. The International Workboat Show is always a massive event in the fall. And then we are also going to be doing Holidays New Orleans style. We have a classic, we have the Sugar Bowl. So lots coming up. So we're continuing to work hard. And you know, Tommy, our sales team in convention sales, they are booking meetings, you know, for 2030, 2035, 2040. I mean, they're looking at the long-term future and booking immediate business, but also very long-term business.
I don't know how you cannot feel good about just having an event go off without a hitch, such a good crowd, such a successful event, and just feel like, you know, you're on a roll and that everything's going well. Congratulations, Kelly.
Thank you. Well, New Orleans is built to host, and again, we need to keep it up, and everyone did a fantastic job, and we're going to keep moving forward and keep welcoming our visitors.
Did you ask the National Automobile Dealers Association, what is it going to take for me to put you in this convention hall today? I'm just kidding. Thank you, Kelly.
Thanks, Tommy.
Have a good
Bye.
Day. All right, we'll take a break. Come back with Dr. Judy Ho. Talk about adult kids getting along with their parents here on WWL.
Have you ever wondered what it's like to experience something paranormal, supernatural, or unexplainable? Join host Jack Wagner on the podcast Otherworld as he explores spine-chilling real stories shared by everyday people who have experienced something unexplainable. Listen each week for first-person testimony from people who have come face-to-face with something that can't just be explained away. Listen and follow Otherworld, an Odyssey podcast, available now on the Odyssey app or wherever you get your podcasts.
It is 9:27. Dr. Judy Ho joins us, clinical and forensic neuropsychologist, host of the Supercharged Life podcast. It is election season, and we're going to talk about how everybody should handle disagreements between parents and adult kids. And I will ask you at 504-260-1870 to weigh in on what your experience has been, both either as the parent of an adult kid or a parent with an adult kid. And with that, we welcome in Dr. Judy Ho. How are you doing, Dr. Judy?
Hey, Tommy. I'm doing great. How are you?
You don't have an adult kid, but you will at some point. Tell me what you've seen in your practice about some of the common problems between adult kids and their parents.
Well, I think especially with election season and with the holidays upon us, a lot of the older issues tend to resurface even as adults. You know, you would love to think that you're moved past it and you're an adult, you're going to handle this better. But I think that the triggers are still there, and they're especially more palpable when there is grounds that are ripe for disagreement, right? So obviously election season, that could be one, especially if your political views differ from your parents. And then the other piece is, as there's going to be more get-togethers overall over the holiday season, just being in your childhood home or around your family members, it just starts to trigger certain dynamics that, you know, good or bad, that were from your childhood, and just more easily having more emotional reactions as a result.
Are there some, let me put it this way, where does a shifting definition of adulthood fit into this? Because some kids were born older than others, right? Other kids maybe at 20 might still be 10. Other kids at 20 might be 40. There's right. Not one size fits all on this, right?
No, there isn't. And of course, we've just discussed that there has been a shifting of adulting in terms of the time frame. I think people usually thought of adulting as, okay, you finish high school, maybe at that point you move out of the house, you start to become more independent. But, you know, we have a lot more people who are in multi-generational families now. That's not uncommon, especially in other cultures, and it has nothing to do really with adulting. It's just that people tend to live with multi-generational relatives. But I think here, it's not quite the norm yet, although there are some shifts towards that. And then it's a little bit confusing because, you know, maybe your parents are still helping to pay your bills. They're sometimes still helping with your laundry. And it causes a bit of a delay in terms of the way that you might communicate with them if you were fully independent, living on your own, versus, hey, they're still wondering what time you're going to be home and they're folding your laundry when you get back. And maybe you don't have a full-time job, so you're constantly spending time with them or they're in the house. And it just extends a lot of both the pros and cons of childhood.
I know people, I don't know if you want to call it a quid pro quo, whatever you want to call it, but I know people have had disagreements with parents, specifically grand, when their parents are babysitters for their kids, because at one point it's either, well, are you giving your grandkid a present, or are you providing this as a daycare provider, and do I owe you or do I not owe you? Is it business? Is it personal? At what point, since you are babysitting the kid, do you have a right to say how the kid's raised? Because although it is my child and I can raise it how I want, if you're going to be with them, then I am responsible for how they behave. So I guess you do have a say in that. Those waters get pretty muddy quick, can't they?
Yeah, definitely. And of course, as the grandparent, you know, they were your parents, so they still feel like they have an onus to tell you what to do. And that maybe they know better because they've, you know, understandably been a parent for longer than you have. And so, and yet this is your child, so you should be the ultimate decision maker. This happens no matter how well-intentioned people are. You know, my mom spent a good amount of time taking care of Luca, and, you know, she definitely has some ideas that differ from mine. And sometimes she'll just implement those ideas without asking me first because she doesn't really feel like she has to, right? And then so that ends up being a discussion of, oh, well, why did you do this? And I would do this other thing. And she's like, well, I think this is better. And then, you know, you can kind of see how that goes.
So what are some of the ways to de-escalate, I guess, if you and your parent are getting into it over maybe your child or just over anything? What are some of the landmines that either parents should avoid or adult children should avoid?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, you know, I think that a big part of this is trying to listen to the other person without getting your point across before they finish. So many times when we're listening to others, we're already thinking about how we're going to have a great comeback, or here's my argument against your point, which is not a good point. We so often do not listen to try to understand the other person's perspective. I mean, this is a person that you love. This is a relative. This is a family member. You know, even if you have fights with them, you care about them. And so if you can start from that and say, okay, you know, I care about this person, and their opinions are valid. They are valued. They are just as valuable as my opinion, even if I don't agree, right? And it's so much more about understanding the other person rather than being right each time. So you have to put your ego aside and at least just open your ears and say, well, I'm open to hearing what they have to say and why they think this way on this issue. Doesn't mean that ultimately you'll be convinced. It's just that you're going to listen, because at the very least, you start to have a little bit more empathy for the other person and you understand their viewpoint better. Because so many times when we disagree, we think, well, that's just a stupid idea. Or how could you support this candidate? And, you know, you just want to get up in arms and you want to know, and you want to think that other person's opinion is not the right one or stupid or all of these different negative things you put on it, but they have probably very valid reasons for thinking the way that they do. And I think that if we can start from that place of, let me just hear why you think the way that you do and why you have this opinion, it can go a long way. And the other person will feel the shift too, when you're not just trying to argue and you're just trying to understand.
And it's not just political candidates. I think as a parent of an adult child, I think we all have a vision of what our child is going to be. You probably have a vision right now of what Luca's going to be, don't you?
I actually don't. No? I actually don't. He's only three.
I think it's good for you.
I'm not even three yet.
No, because
I know. I'm like, I don't really know what he's going to be like as an adult. Like, and I'm not sure where that's good. Yeah, so I've actually surprised myself by being relatively mindful during
that's
his,
because you're a clinical
years.
And forensic neuropsychologist. That's why you're.
Oh,
you
I don't know
have,
about that, Tommy.
No,
oh no,
but,
I still have my own neurosis.
I think we all, you know, sometimes tend to think our kid's going to graduate from Princeton and cure cancer and become the president, as well as curing cancer and to make world peace and find a source of renewable energy that's green and everything else, but make everybody happy.
Right.
And you know, that doesn't always pan out. Not everybody can go to X, Y, Yale or Harvard. Not everybody can be a president. Not everybody can do this. Not everybody can do that. So I think at some point, as a parent of an adult child, you have to do your best, step back, and then realize that just as you did when you were 18 or 21, whatever you want to pick the age, that your kid's going to make choices, be it a tattoo, be it a piercing, be it whatever, that maybe you would not have made for yourself, but that doesn't make it wrong. And you also have to factor in that it's not 1980, right?
Right, exactly. And it can be so hard, right? Because we do hang our hopes and dreams on our child. Even if I am relatively mindful at this stage, you know, there is still so much of, you know, wanting Luca to have the best childhood, like, you know, sometimes going even overboard to like make sure he has a good day. Like, you know, that's obviously just a parent, you know, being a parent, you want the best for your kids. And that's where some of these expectations come from. But also, I think if we're being honest with ourselves, some of these expectations come from, well, maybe certain unrealized dreams you didn't have as a child or that you didn't get to live out. Or maybe you really want your childhood or adulthood to be different than your path, right? You don't want them to go through the difficulties that you did. But in that way, you're not fully allowing them to actualize and figure it out, especially as they get older. They can do that as opposed to Lucas. Almost three. He's not really ready to figure everything out himself. So I think that's the tough thing. And also parents, we have all the memories of when they were babies, when they couldn't fend for themselves. And in some ways that's still imprinted in our minds, even when they're 30, it's like, wait, no, you're still my child. Right. And my parents tell me that all the time. You're still our child. And I was like, yeah, I get it. I'll always be your child, no matter how old I get, you know? So I think that, you know, maybe if you're an adult child listening to this and you have some arguments with your parents, it's nice to have a little empathy for where your parents are coming from, especially when they're seemingly a little bit bossy or maybe overbearing. It is coming usually from a good place.
I'm getting a lot of text here about tattoos and parents having a hard time with their adult kids with tattoos because I guess when, you know, somebody texted and said the only people that had tattoos when I was growing up were sailors, and now my daughter has one. That whole dynamic, the paradigm, whatever phrase you want to use, has changed. So how would you tell parents to adjust to adult kids who have tattoos and the parents don't like it? Because I'll tell you, once they show you the tattoo, it's a little late to say, why'd you get that? Because it's not coming off, right?
Right, exactly. Yeah, you know, that's a tough one. Again, you may not have taken this path. You may not have made this decision to permanently decorate your body, but it is, however, your child, you know, your adult child now, body, you know, and you don't have to love it, but it over the grand scheme of things, our life is so short. You got to pick your battles. Is this something that you really want to hang your hat on, have a huge fight about? Or is this something that you can say, hey, look, I'm super annoyed that you did this and I'm not sure I like it, but then you drop it because there's other bigger things to deal with. And ultimately it's the relationship with your child. And so there's going to be bigger arguments that you might need to have about things that are truly important, maybe relate to your values, how you want to live life, as opposed to why did you do this stupid thing that I wouldn't have done?
But and again, I'm getting a lot of texts on this, to allay fears, the social environment is not what it used to be as it relates to tattoos, right? They don't bear the same stigma that they once did, or do they?
No, I don't think so. I mean, especially if you're in certain circles. I mean, there's some circles of tattooing that is just, I mean, people just love it for the artwork, right? I mean, I think in the past, right, I think what you're alluding to is that in the past, tattoos were kind of associated with a certain image. It's like, oh, you're like a, you know, a bad boy.
Right.
You know, this means that you're going to get involved in other dangerous activities. And now I know so many people who have tattoos that are just like gentle as a lamb. Like they've got their entire body tatted up and they're just like the kindest individual you've ever met. So I think so many people now do it because they love the artwork. And that's a really different vibe than 30 or 40 years ago.
Yeah, and I think parents, you cannot maybe like the way it looks on your kid. That's one thing, but you got to remember it's your kid. And the other thing you got to do is remember that times have changed if you're trying to protect them. I would suggest to anyone, maybe not on the face,
Mm-hmm.
Thoughts?
Exactly. I think that that is really tough because it does connote a certain certain image, one, and two, it's not professional for certain jobs, right? I mean, people are not going to hire you if you have, you know, a face full of tattoos for certain industries. That's not true of every job,
right.
But, you know, there is a snap decision that we all make. And I don't know if we talked about this, Tommy, but first impressions are so hard to break.
Mm-hmm.
One first impression takes 13 things and situations that would be, and like basically the opposite of that first impression for you to say, oh, maybe my first impression was wrong. So if you think about a person who was late to a first meeting, right? You literally have to be early or on time for 13 more meetings before your boss and your coworkers are like, oh, this is not a person who's flaky and late. I mean, so that it's hard to break when somebody makes an impression about you.
We're going to talk about that at some point in the future. Real quick, before we let you go, somebody texted and said, how to handle a relationship with a child's girlfriend, boyfriend that you don't approve. I can tell them this.
Oh, boy.
From a parent's standpoint, if you want to drive them toward that person, start criticizing that person and tell them, forbid them from seeing them. That'll drive them over there like you wouldn't believe.
True.
But your thoughts?
I agree with you. I mean, look, you cannot control all of these things and you have to just do your best. And I think the first question that you should ask and the most important is just, does this person make my child happy? And if they treat your child well and they make them happy, then I think maybe just you'll have to keep your opinions relatively to yourself. Although you can, of course, express them. You can say, look, you know, he's not my favorite or she's not my favorite. But there's nothing you can do to control it. And like you said, Tommy, the more that you force a wedge, the more they'll stick together. And before you know it, it's their wedding day. So got to just breathe and try to focus on the big picture. Do they make my child happy? And if so, try your best to accept them, even if you don't love them.
Thank you, Dr. Judy. A pleasure as always. Dr. Judy O, clinical and forensic neuropsychologist, host of the Supercharged Life podcast, 941. When we come back, Newell Norman's going to join us a little bit early because he was the sheriff of Jefferson Parish, as we all know, and he was, I forgot the Latin term for it, the tax collector officios or some kind of stuff like that. And we're going to talk about the governor's plan and inventory taxes and local governments and sales taxes, because who better to find out the way it works, who better to find it out from than Newell Norman, who's dealt with it. 942, 18 till 10, traffic now, WWL. 946 now, 14 till 10. Newell Norman, nice enough to join us a little bit early here today because we were having a conversation throughout the morning about the governor's call for a special session about tax reform and about inventory taxes. And Newell Norman, as the sheriff, was the, what was it, sheriff, tax collector, ex officio?
Ex officio tax collector.
That's what it is, ex officio tax collector, which means, of course, the big tax collector in charge. Tell me, Newell, about this whole thing. I don't even know where to start because I got to tell you, I don't know an inventory tax from a hole in the ground, all right?
Tommy, I just wanted to kind of clear up a couple of things that you guys were talking about with Tyler Bridges. Tyler was right that inventory taxes are part of the ad valorem tax sphere, and that's property taxes, otherwise known as property taxes.
I'm going to slow down a little bit. Ad valorem is property taxes.
Is property taxes.
Okay.
And you have business property taxes, you have residential property taxes, and in the business world, one of those property taxes is inventory. You're taxed on inventory. There are some parishes that are more heavily reliant on inventory taxes than others. Mm-hmm. So, for example, in Jefferson Parish, probably not nearly as much as St. John Parish,
okay,
because of the nature of the businesses located within that parish.
Let me slow you down because I'm trying to understand this, all right? Because you know this. You dealt with this for years of your life. I'm just trying to understand this. So when you talk about inventory, we're talking about if I sell, and I use the example of jerseys, if I sell jerseys or football team stuff, I pay a tax on what I have in my warehouse, what I have on the property in the state of Louisiana, in a parish, how does that work?
No? What you have on your shelves on December 31st.
In the state or in a parish?
In the simplest way, what you have on your shelves on December 31st in the parish.
In the parish.
Because that amount, that valuation is self-reported by the company to the assessor.
Okay.
The assessor figures out the assessment, puts it on the tax rolls, sends the tax rolls to the collector. And the collector can be a sheriff, and in some parishes it's outsourced to other individuals, but predominantly sheriffs in the business of collecting ad valorem taxes.
Now, I ask that because you talked about the nature of the business, and I presume if I own a jersey store or a flirty girl like Kelly Schultz was talking about, hang on, I know you're getting impatient with me, but I'm trying to understand this. That's different than if you own a manufacturing plant or a grain elevator or something like that?
A lot of those businesses that are retail or have modified their approach over the last 20 to 30 years, and you've heard about the JIT system, J-I-T, developed by the Japanese, predominantly in the automaking sphere. It's called just-in-time. Mm-hmm. It's a highly appropriate way of managing your inventory so you don't have a lot of your cash tied up in inventory. So you take possession of inventory just in time of when you need it. And a lot of businesses are very smart about how they manage their inventory, and a lot of their inventory leaves their businesses long before the calculation is made by the assessors. But there are some businesses that are not as likely to be able to do such, and that's more of these larger business, industrial plants and the like. And that's why you have this. It's not a one size fit all. Some parishes are more reliant on inventory taxes than others. Jefferson Parish, for example, it's a big number, but it's not a number that's not manageable to be able to overcome within this tax reformation that's being put forward by Governor Landry, mm-hmm. which I applaud the effort. I'm just not sure that we're giving it enough time to really adequately debate all of the topics that need to be debated. Now, where you brought up state centralization,
yeah.
that has nothing to do with ad valorem taxes. That has everything to do with sales and use taxes. And not all sheriffs collect sales and use tax in their respective parishes. So, for example, in Orleans Parish, it's collected by the Department of Revenue. In Jefferson, we are one of just a handful of sheriffs that collect all taxes that are generated within the parish. The school board tax, all the other property taxes, sales taxes that are generated, occupational license tax. We collect all the fines and fees within the courthouse as well. So we act as the revenue department, and there's only a couple of sheriffs that actually do that. In other parishes, it's collected by the police jury or the school boards. And then within the cities, there are collectors within the cities as well, and some cities outsource that activity to the parish. So it is a complicated system in one respect, but in another respect, it's not. We hear from business owners all the time, this is key to really promoting an accelerated business enterprise across the state. And it's funny because I've testified up there in the legislature many times, and I ask these business owners, so you collect data within your own business at a real granular level, right, at a low level. So I could ask you about your store at Veterans and Causeway, let's say, and you're going to be able to tell me gross sales, what your bottom line is, net profit, and everything at that entity, right? And they typically reluctantly say yes, mm-hmm. because they know that the sales tax report is an app, and you plug in one number, gross sales, and the app works out everything for you.
Mm-hmm.
So anytime they start talking about this, it's disingenuous. And I'll tell you why. What they don't
Wait, anytime who starts talking about what?
These business owners about saying state centralization
okay.
is key.
All right.
Because what we have in this state is that the state sphere, when you look at the state, you know, they get a portion of sales tax. Locals do as well.
Mm-hmm.
The state sphere of taxable transactions, that sphere of items you can actually have a tax on, is far greater than that of locals. The states carve out to themselves that they are the only ones that are allowed to tax, to impose a sales tax on certain activities and transactions. And local government is left with all the rest. So there's a difference there. That's why the state, it was easy for them to give up sales and use taxes on prescription drugs. It wasn't as easy for a lot of local jurisdictions because without it, they couldn't make ends meet. But from the business perspective, one of the things that they really don't like is that local government actually knows the business enterprises within their jurisdiction better than anybody else. And they conduct more audits, because remember, this is an honor system, right? Mm-hmm. They conduct more audits to determine whether or not these transactions are being appropriately reported. So if you go to any retail outlet, you're going to have cash transactions, check transactions, credit card transactions, all kinds of different transactions, right? Multiple cash registers in there. Sometimes you have app failures. Sometimes you have technology failures. Things fall out. You pick this up in audits, and some people just, quite frankly, cheat. And the reality is that they're cheating every member or every citizen within that parish when they do so. Locals tend to audit more than the state. In fact, Jefferson Parish, as a single entity, we audited more companies than the state did throughout the entire state. Why? Because it's important to have the necessary revenue. They are collecting it as a fiduciary for the local government. It's not their money. The consumer paid it. And what we want to make sure is they're not keeping it, and that it's being forward to local government, because that was the intended purpose. The consumer knows it. They know it. Everybody knows it. We just make sure that we're keeping the system honest. Now, the flip side is that there are some costs to doing that for the business, and not all business. Most businesses don't like to have some regulatory individual in their business all the time. Mm-hmm. But, you know, it's rare that when we conduct audits that, you know, that we don't find something. And so, and I mean that in the truest sense, because we actually find that maybe they overpaid, mm-hmm. and we give them money back in some cases. And that's not unusual. And other cases where they've underpaid, and cases where they've appropriately paid. So this is not a one-size-fit-all, and it's going to end up being a very complex thing. And I know that there are negotiations going on right now as it relates to inventory taxes, because of the different positions that individual parishes find themselves in as to how reliant they are on the taxes that are generated by the inventory tax. And in some cases, the state's going to have to get really creative and exotic to make that up for that parish to end up being revenue neutral. And I would suspect, because the last two times that we looked at it, no one was able to craft a situation where it would make up the difference.
I know it's complicated. Tell me what else you got coming up, Newell, because we're about out of time.
Not we are going to visit with Billy Nungesser, Ron Fauché. We have our NOLA Coalition CEO, Greg Ravy of Heroes of New Orleans. Colonel Alex Gann will go to Israel and talk to him as well. And I've got a couple of open segments to talk about a number of topics.
I appreciate your time, Newell, in explaining that. Newell's next on WWL.
Thank you, sir.
Have you ever wondered what it's like to experience something paranormal, supernatural, or unexplainable? Join host Jack Wagner on the podcast Otherworld as he explores spine-chilling real stories shared by everyday people who have experienced something unexplainable. Listen each week for first-person testimony from people who have come face-to-face with something that can't just be explained away. Listen and follow Otherworld, an Odyssey podcast, available now on the Odyssey app or wherever you get your podcasts.
Oh, 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 O'Reilly!
Protect your vehicle's engine with a full synthetic oil change and save with Mobil 1 at O'Reilly Auto Parts. Purchase 5 quarts of Mobil 1 full synthetic motor oil and receive a $10 O'Reilly gift card after rebate. See store for details. With your Mobil 1 purchase, you'll also receive 2x points during Old Rewards Bonus Points Month at O'Reilly Auto Parts.
Oh, 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 O'Reilly! Auto Parts!